Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we've all been following what happened to Sandra Bland in Texas and of the growth of a movement that's been around to say her name, to remember what happens to black women in this society. And one of the people writing about that very profoundly, I think, has been Danny McLean, a contributing writer for The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. And Danny, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. And folks, please join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, but do call. 410-319-8888 is the number. You wrote this, the last piece I read that you wrote here, Turned Deadly for Sandra Bland, and what happened to her on that day and who she was, why we have to remember her name. In the face of every time this happens, people trying to degrade and dehumanize the person who was killed.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think we've seen that time and again. So, you know, soon after, 2 years ago, when Trayvon Martin, actually when George Zimmerman was, you know, exonerated, essentially, you know, we had lived through these reports of hearing about how Trayvon Martin had been suspended from school, how he had smoked marijuana. With Michael Brown soon after his death, the New York Times wrote this story, which I think was just meant to be a profile of who Mike Brown was before his passing, but, you know, played up the fact that he had had trouble, you know, of various types, that he was a marijuana smoker. With Eric Garner, we heard that he hadn't paid his child support. There always tends to be, you know, these details of a person's life that are dragged, you know, that are found and publicized after they've died at the hands of police or at the hands of a vigilante or while in police custody. And we've seen that same thing happening with Sandra Bland. Late last week, there were these reports that, you know, she had copious amounts of marijuana in her system, that this is something that the toxicology report had found. Even prior to that, there was a news report out of Chicago saying that she you know, had a number of police stops, both in Texas and in the Chicago area. And that was the headline. But of course, once you continued reading, you saw that the vast majority of these police encounters were traffic stops. So yeah, we're seeing with Sandra Bland the same kind of, you know, efforts to cast doubts about her character and to somehow imply that, you know, because she had had these run-ins with police and because she had, you know, allegedly consumed marijuana. We don't know exactly when that had happened, but, you know, apparently while she was in jail somehow. But, you know, these are, you know, somehow raising questions about who she was and implying that somehow she deserved her fate.
So, but that is, as you wrote, as many people have written, this is the no angel narrative that's always kind of thrown out.
That's right. That's right. I mean, we saw it with, you know, I called it the no angel narrative because those are precisely the words that were used in the New York Times piece about Mike Brown. You know, Michael Brown was no angel. And it's just, you know, I think especially with this, in the Sandra Bland case, this conversation about her marijuana use, you know, one of the police encounters that she had had prior to her death did have to do with possession of marijuana and drug paraphernalia. And I'm really bothered by this because it seems like we're at this moment in this country culturally where marijuana is mainstream, right? So the New York Times runs a piece about these young white women who are entrepreneurs in Denver who host a quote, vape and vinyasa yoga class, right? Where it's like, come and do vinyasa yoga and smoke marijuana. There's a piece that ran in Time magazine that was called something like Meet Colorado's Pot Smokers. And it's these photographs of these, you know, young hipster looking people smoking weed. And so it's frustrating because we're at this moment where in some states, of course, where there have been, you know, successful legalization efforts, we see marijuana kind of like celebrated or at least talked about as
right.
It's this hip, quirky thing. And of course, but the face of marijuana users, more and more in mainstream media is of a white person or light skinned person or, you know, someone who's framed as an entrepreneur and someone who's making smart business decisions. Of course, we know that there are, you know, way too many black and brown people locked up on drug charges, you know, nonviolent drug charges, some of which, you know, have to do with marijuana sales or use. So it's particularly frustrating the way that they're dragging this alleged marijuana use into the public conversation about Sandra Bland, because I thought we had kind of gotten to a point in this country where marijuana, we're talking about marijuana in you know, a similar way to, as to how we talk about alcohol or other legal intoxicants.
And I guess it's very frustrating to always hear this kind of degradation of a human being who's been killed. Mm-hmm. It is somehow not well behaved, not fit for society, always getting in trouble, not to be empathized with. That just fits the narrative of never holding anybody responsible.
Right.
For this kind of violence and death.
Yeah, as if it's somehow, you know, the perpetrator is less culpable because of the victim's past. And it doesn't, you know, whether or not Sandra Bland had marijuana in her system has nothing to do with what we can see in the dash cam video and in the bystander video, you know, in terms of how Officer Insignia was treating her as he was, you know, taking her into custody.
And when you look at that, I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt, Danny.
No, that's fine.
I'm sorry. When you look at that, and what you're just saying, and also look at the response to the police officer, the kind of vehemence, impoliteness, and aggressiveness.
Yeah.
Of that officer is never talked about in the same vein as her marijuana use or her traffic problems with the court.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, it's been interesting, this conversation that's come out of people viewing the dash cam video in particular. I mean, I think first we saw the bystander video and it's like, why is she being tackled? You know, she was stopped, you know, because she changed lanes without signaling. So how does that end up with her tackled by the side of the road? When the dash cam video was released last week, it raised a whole number of new questions that really center on what you point out. Why is he, you see this conversation that starts, you know, and it seems pretty calm and, you know, even polite. The officer initially seems polite, but to see the how quickly it escalates and how, you know, frankly, in my opinion, unprofessional he becomes. You know, how, again, I'm not an expert on police, you know, conduct, but I write a lot about it, and I observe things fairly closely, and I think even just from my personal experience, I can say, you almost get the feeling that his ego starts, that he starts to feel challenged, and he just feels like she's not deferring to him in the way that she should. You never, you know, he never says that she's doing anything to break the law. He just becomes increasingly frustrated by things like, you know, he asks her to put out her cigarette and she says, why do I have to put out my cigarette? I'm sitting in my own car. He keeps saying things to her. And, you know, we know that Sandra Bland was someone who was very inspired by and motivated by the Black Lives Matter organizing that's happening all over the country. She would do this kind of video series where she would, you know, talk about the issues of the day, police violence. So she's someone who clearly knew her rights and who wanted to assert the fact that she knew her rights and asked questions about what was happening to her at that moment. And you just see him becoming increasingly frustrated by the fact that he has to account for how he's treating her.
Sandy, I'm sorry. Danny, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just think that's, you know, what we see in that video is just someone who, an officer who just, upon feeling like he's losing control of the situation, reacts increasingly violently.
But there's also something here, I think, that has to be brought in that people are not talking about enough, which is the behavior of people in authority, of police in authority, and what they do with that authority. The incident of Sandra Bland being dragged out of a car, the numerous incidents you wrote about in your piece and other people have written about in their pieces of women being, pregnant women being thrown to the ground and handcuffed and sat upon and shot and killed and more. And there was a story here on our program about 6 months ago, maybe a little bit more. A woman who is a leader in this community talked about being stopped by a police officer late at night, a white officer. She's a black woman. Comes to a car, takes his flashlight and runs it from her head down to her toe and back up her body again, asking her if she was a party girl. And, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I think we somehow, when I think about that and I think about the piece you wrote about what happened at what happened at the Netroots Nation, mm-hmm. where activists got up and confronted Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders, two presidential candidates, about what's happening why are they not addressing issues of race in this country? They're connected to me here. Something is afoot. And I think that what you talked about at Netroots is directly connected to what you've been writing about Sandra Bland and more.
Right. So the first point that you raised about, you know, just the fact that we can't view what's happened to Sandra Bland in a vacuum. And I think one thing that's really incredible about this moment is that we more and more people are talking about the intersections of gender and race and how Black women are not immune from police violence. You know, I think for so long, our conversations about police brutality and police violence has been a conversation about Black and brown men. And more, you know, we just are realizing that that's an incomplete picture of what's happening. So not just Sandra Bland, but Rekia Boyd, who was killed by an off-duty police officer in Chicago, you know, who felt like she and her friends were talking too loudly and opened fire and shot Rekia Boyd in the head. And he was, you know, just recently, the charges were dismissed in that case. Tanisha Anderson, you know, there have been a number of these cases where we see these women who are, you know, being treated, who are being abused by police. And I think it's because they're Black, but I think that there's also this way in which Black womanhood is perceived as being, you know, all of the stereotypes, right? Like we're aggressive. We don't know our place. We don't know when to shut our mouths. That I think, you know, these stereotypes are playing out in officers' heads when they confront women, Black women. So I think that that's an important piece about this moment is that, of course, this is heartbreaking that Sandra Bland's family is having to, you know, doesn't have answers about how their daughter, sister, auntie ended up dead after 3 days in jail following a traffic stop. But I think it's one of the things that's coming out of this situation is a more complex conversation about police violence that includes, you know, what's happening to Black women. Your point about the piece that I wrote about Netroots, yes. So, you know, as you said, what happened was last weekend at Netroots Nation, the largest gathering of liberal and progressive activists in the country. A number of people who are connected to Black Lives Matter organizing, mostly Black women. It was an event that was, I think, led by BAJI, the Black Alliance on Just Immigration. Black women demanded that former Governor O'Malley and Senator Sanders state explicitly what they plan to do about structural racism. And it was a fascinating kind of exchange because we saw both candidates fumble. We saw, you know, Governor O'Malley essentially, you know, Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, which was just kind of a awkward thing to say. You know, I think many activists with that movement would say, we already know that white lives matter. That's not under dispute. We need to know what you as a president would do to make sure that our policies, you know, confirm that Black Lives Matter. And we saw Senator Sanders kind of, you know, be very dismissive and say, you know, yeah, I get it, right? I've been working on civil rights issues for 50 years. You're not telling me anything new, which was just kind of, it was a tone deaf response. I mean, you can't say that in the midst of the type of movement that is afoot right now. You can't kind of rest on your laurels and say, well, I marched, you know, in the 60s or, you know, yeah, I get it. So, you need to kind of confront explicitly what these activists were pushing for them to address.
So but I want to ask this question, but Jeff, we're going to come to your call as your first caller up here, 410-319-8888. But very quickly, I want to get this in and then we'll go right to our callers, which is that I was reading the interview the other week that John Nichols had in The Nation magazine, for whom you also write,
right.
About his interview with Bernie Sanders, which I thought was a great interview. And I'm glad that he pushed him and he started talking about his history and civil rights. But then I wrote a letter to John and to Katrina Vandenhoeffel, mm-hmm. saying that something's amiss here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about it. And we need to use the pages of the Nation and places to talk about it, which is that why Bernie Sanders, who is this progressive, really left progressive U.S. senator, self-declared socialist, talks about income inequality, but afraid to make that leap and make the connections between that and racial inequality in America.
Right.
You know, there's something, what do you think is missing here?
A race analysis, right? I mean.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, I think that's what's missing. I think Bernie Sanders is from Vermont, right?
He's from Brooklyn.
right. I'm sorry. Thank you for the correction. He's from Brooklyn, but he, you know, became the political force that he is today through his, you know, if I remember correctly, he was mayor of Burlington. Like, he's someone who, it's not like he was figuring out how to navigate these issues in a particularly multiracial context. Vermont's pretty white. So I think that, and of course, I mean, he's been a senator, he's been in DC for many years. So I don't say that to like excuse his blind spots, but I think it's a common thing in the progressive movement. I think some people may make some assumption that, you know, if you're progressive, you're good on race just because you are, but that's not how it works, right? I mean, in the piece that I wrote about Netroots, I used this personal example, which is that in 2004, I was doing voter organizing in Cincinnati. Yeah. So I was doing voter organizing in Cincinnati. I was like, you know, a couple of years out of college. Some friends and I decided that we were going to link up with this national effort called the League of Pissed Off Voters. And that the point would be, you know, that we would kind of bring a progressive angle to the conversation about the presidential election in Cincinnati. So, of course, we were in a swing state. It was a critical election. We had lived through 4 years of Bush at that point. And, you know, we were trying to, we were doing like putting together voter guides and going out and doing voter registration and voter education. And we're trying to sell this candidate, John Kerry, to our peers, to young, you know, mostly people of color. And it was just a conversation that didn't have any wheels because nobody was checking for John Kerry. Like, who is John Kerry and what has he done for Black communities? It wasn't immediately obvious to folks as we were trying to get them excited about, you know, turning out at the polls and casting their vote for John Kerry. So I think, you know, as someone who's been engaged in either participating in progressive organizing or observing it closely for many years, I've encountered many white progressives who don't have a race analysis at all. I've been asked to organize on behalf of white candidates who clearly don't have a race analysis. And so, you know, it's not obvious what their, you know, victory would mean for people of color. And I think people are tired of it, right? And I think that's what we saw at Netroots is these women are saying, no, you need to say now. You need to say now where in your platform you're going to address race issue, structural racism in a meaningful way. And if you can't do that, then please don't come to us in the next 6 months asking us to go out and into our communities and get people fired up for you, because no, you're not going to use us in that way anymore. And we're not going to be using these tactics that you know, don't take into account what our peers and what people in our community actually need and what they need to hear from you. I think it's brilliant organizing that we're seeing right now.
I think it's really, it's time. And I think there's many things it's time for and the many reasons why this moment is that time. And I think that that is emblematic of all of that. And I really do hope that publications like The Nation pick up the mantle that some of us threw down the other week when we wrote saying we've got to start dealing with this on the pages of magazines like that that are read by predominantly white progressives in America.
Yep.
So 410-319-8888. Jeff, you're on the air.
I hope you'll keep me on the phone long enough so I can connect Muhammad Ali and his anti-war activism and going to jail for it, being jailed just like Sandra Bland was. Well, not quite like that, but thank God they didn't kill him. But John Kerry, 10 years of Bush, really, and a whole bunch of things. I hope you'll keep me on the line.
Well, we don't have a lot of time, but please just get into what you want to say. But Muhammad Ali was never in jail. He was threatened with jail, but he never did time.
I thought he couldn't box. I thought he was in jail.
No, he couldn't box, but he wasn't jailed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, go ahead.
They took his license away.
They did.
That was sort of prison for him. But, okay. I want to talk about Freddie Gray and Sandra Bland, too, and the fact that Jack Young has on his desk the stupid naming of Lake Rowland as Lake Rowland Park rather than something like Robert E. Lee Freddie Gray Park, which would show the history of Baltimore as being a southern, in fact, slave-selling town, as well as Freddie Gray's death. I mean, it would relate the two of them, and not take away the historic name of Lake Rowland Park.
Right.
That's something I've been wanting to talk to your producer about, actually. But I do want to point out, too, that I haven't heard lately, and this relates to electing people like Bush and Halliburton. Oh, I mean Dick Cheney, not Halliburton.
Right.
But we will continue to absurdly call Halliburton, Philip Morris Tobacco, you know, Virginia companies, those companies which now elect our presidents, we will continue to call this Democratic election of people that we wouldn't vote for, as the your guest was just pointing out. We're not going to vote for John Kerry unless we know something about his activism on behalf of people like Muhammad Ali and us. And he and Muhammad Ali weren't exactly on the same page, but it is related, the anti-warism. In any case, what I'm trying to say is I want to hear what happened to the guy who flew his gyrocopter and then got completely snowed over, and nobody, not our congressmen or senators, have raised his name to say we've got to get K Street out of Washington, D.C., and start having elections by people,
right,
not by corporations, which are called people, by John Roberts and the fascist Supreme Court that we have.
Okay, Jeff, do you have a question, or do you just wanted to make that statement, which is fine?
Well, how do we get more conversation going about? Oh my God, I didn't even mention the text messages that I heard about. I think Brooke Gladstone and On the Media. So
right,
Jeff,
we're almost out of time, but I think that's part of what we're talking about here in America is how you get these conversations going that gets beyond just what we do here in the air. But let me get another caller in here, and I'll come right back to our guest so she can wrap this up for us, Danny McLean. Let's go to Donna on line four.
How you doing?
Good morning, Donna.
Pretty good. And always a good show, and your guest is wonderful as well.
Yes, she is. Thank you.
And I like the point your guest made about, you know, everybody always forgets that African-American women are going through the same, atrocities that our black males are going through. It just never gets shown or publicized, and no one really has done enough studies. And so your guest really pointed out a lot of very interesting things about what happens to us when we get stopped by the police. My comment is, and I guess my question is, because if you look at the media always portrays African-American women negatively. You know, we're sexy, we walk around, you know, provocative, we're hoochies, we're hoes. And so when the police have to deal with us, especially white police officers, and some of our African-Americans and other Hispanics, Latino, their images of us are exactly what those names are. We're, you know, we loud mouth, we talk loud, we sassy, we don't know our place. And until we change that mindset and actually get to the media to stop that portraying of us, to get the media to stop that, and I think African-American women are going to have to step up more to the plate and actually send a message to the media that we will not no longer tolerate that, because we are the biggest spenders and all this, you know, the wealth that goes around us, but we're being treated as if we're worthless and we're less than. So I wanted you guys to talk about that, and I have to listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna, so much. Danny?
Yeah, I think the caller raises a really important point. Like, what is contributing to these stereotypes about who we are, who Black women are. And I think, you know, everything from, you know, what we see on television, to what we hear on the radio. I think it's a just question. There are many people who are doing great work to try to call those things out and hold the corporate forces that, you know, create this type of programming to hold these forces accountable and ask questions about why are Black women portrayed in these particular ways. Color of Change has run some interesting campaigns on that topic. You know, but one thing that I think is really interesting right now is a lot of this Black Lives Matter organizing is led by women, Black women. And I don't want to discount the very important work that, of course, you know, Black men and gender nonconform, you know, people who don't fit in either binary are doing. Of course, it's a collaborative community effort. But I think the fact that, you know, it's three women who co-founded the kind of Black Lives Matter movement or frame, at least that phrase, three Black women, two of whom identify as queer, the women who rushed the stage, the people who rushed the stage at Netroots Nation, Black women. So there's kind of this, you know, alternative narrative that is really being held up right now of Black women as leaders, Black women as strong, Black women as strategists, Black women as brilliant thinkers about the conditions mm-hmm. of our communities. And that's not to say that we haven't always been that. We have.
Right.
But because, you know, there's national attention on this movement and that's lifting up these, you know, Black women like Alicia Garza, like Patrice Cullors, like Opal Tometi. I think it's providing people with a different way of thinking about us. Oh, here are these incredibly strong, brilliant women who are, you know, in part leading this movement. So I think we have an interesting opportunity to change some of these perceptions.
I think so too. And the problem is, of course, the media keeps putting on the air the voices and names of men and not the women.
Right.
How shocking. And so so on this day, as we did in our day in history, remembering that this was the birthday of Queen Mother Moore, mm-hmm. That it was good to have you, Danny McLean, on to help us walk through this. And we look forward to having you on very soon once again. And thanks for all the writing and work you do.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. It's always a pleasure.
Same here. Thanks so much, Danny.
Take care.
That was Danny McLean, who was a contributing writer for The Nation, a fellow at The Nation Institute. We'll be connecting to her articles that we read for this interview on our website at sinoshow.org, so please check those out. If you haven't read her, you need to read her. And on the way to break, we're hearing Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, recording this day in 1986, in a concert in Budapest. They were the first Western act to perform in the Eastern Bloc nations since Louis Armstrong did in 1964. We're taking a brief break and come back and look at that new poll about race in America. Does it tell us anything new? What's really under that poll? We have a great group of guests to talk about that. Stay with us.